Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 2nd. Today's session is Connecting with Earth as Revelation, presented by Norman Habel. The number is 2002-04. Let's listen in.
To reconnect with Earth. One of the concerns we have, I have, and various other people have, is that progressively we have cut ourselves off from Earth in different ways and no longer relate to Earth in the same kind of way that lots of other people do. I know in Australia the Indigenous people that I've worked with and in various ways, they have a connection with Earth that I envy. It's very close, very intimate, very spiritual, very profound. In all kinds of ways I learn things about our kinship, our connection with the Earth. And on Monday we talked about our connection with the Earth as a parent. We all come from the Earth. Earth, in a sense, is our biological parent, from whom we are derived, and every aspect of our beings comes from Earth ultimately. The portrait in Genesis 1 is a poetic portrait, but in reality that's true. You know, we do come from Earth, and we do return to Earth, and that Earth is therefore a parent. And we talked about different things in each day. And today I want to look at Earth in a very special way and try to see something about Earth that I actually haven't seen before in any of the biblical texts. Often we read these texts, we read them because we're concerned about the human story or what the God story is, but we don't read the text with the key character being Earth. Earth is the primary character in many stories. Or if we ask the question, what is Earth saying in this text that we've lost or hidden or missed? So our connection with the Earth is important. And we've also, to help personalize this, we've talked about letters to the Earth, letters from the Earth, letters from Earth. And a couple of these have been written by various people. I don't know if there's anybody here. Did you write a letter?
We haven't yet.
Not yet.
I'd love you to. If we did, we'd make a collection of letters to Earth from Holden. You thought you might. A couple of people. So if you have, there's nobody here who did last night, did that? Several people did the other day, and they're very nice, very interesting. And the whole idea is to somehow or another make that connection with Earth by, in a sense, personalising our relationship in a way that we haven't done before. And the letter to Earth that I wrote in connection with this one, a part of it, on the board, I'll read just a bit of it. Time has come for me to ask the hard question. Who are you? I know that you're my biological parent, the source of my life, but is there more? Who are you really? At school I learned that you're a planet. Recent photographs reveal that you're a beautiful green-blue planet. Ecologists tell us that you're a fragile planet. Now scientists tell us that you are a piece of starch spinning in space. I'm a spiritual being and part of a spiritual life on this planet. I assume, therefore, that you are also spiritual, something more than dancing dust or a footstool for God. I want you to tell me who you really are. Are there any stories about your origin that give me an insight into the wonderful being I know to be my parent called Earth? And so it goes on. So what I want to start with is to talk a little bit between us. And to some extent, I'm searching my way, because nobody's tried to do this before, not within the mainline Christian church at least, is to try and understand our relationship to Earth better. And each time I ask a set of questions about how we've understood our relationship to heaven or Earth, and the both of them. And this, today I'd like to explore... You don't have another verse to your song, do you?
No.
No. Today I'd like to explore the question of revelation, first of all. When we talk about revelation and God revealing God's self, what sort of things come to your mind? When God reveals God's self, what sort of things do you remember? What sort of things come to your mind from when you were young, from when you were a child? What does revelation, if God decides to reveal God's self, what sort of pictures come to your mind? From the biblical tradition, from your past, from your Sunday school?
Burning bush.
That's a good one. All right, the burning bush, yes. So here's, we'll just list a few of these just so we get a feel for it. something quite anomalous. One was the burning bush. Just a few of these pictures. What else?
Cloud with lightning.
All right, yes. Lightning. And the picture is often zap, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a revelation of God, usually in a judgment form.
Mm-hmm.
It's striking. So revelation can be in judgment form, or it can be in all kinds of form.
How about the Star of Bethlehem?
All right, there's another one. Star. That's a very good example. And the star was clearly linked to what? The heaven, the sky. And it pointed to Earth, didn't it? So, all right, let's get a few more of these.
Rock.
Rock. Which rock? Which rock was a revelation? Well, the one that with all the water came out of it, when Moses hid it, and out came the water. In other words, it was a revelation. It wasn't natural, it was an unnatural kind of relationship. And the bush is unnatural as well. What else? Any other images? Huh?
Angels.
All right, angels. Frequently you have an angel. When God wants to reveal God's message or something like that, an angel comes to Mary or whoever it might be, or Anna or somebody else. Any other images of revelation? That's common. That you can think of.
Tongues of fire.
Hmm?
Tongues of fire?
Fire, okay, yes, very frequent. Fire. And fire fell from heaven, right? Yes, fire. Yes. Any others? Frequently, the picture is similar to what I wanted to say, I said yesterday. If we've got heaven here and we've got earth below, frequently revelation is seen to come from heaven. It's from heaven to earth. So some kind of thing that is hits the earth and thereby changes the scene. So it can be an angel, it can be a lightning, it can be a star, and it can be acts of judgment. And frequently, the revelation that God is acting, at least it's interpreted to be a revelation. So, for example, what happens in the plagues?
People die.
Yeah. Well, God intervenes and sends onto earth certain things, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So the earth is hit with plagues. Or the earth is hit with lightning or something else. And a lot of the portraits of God's judgment, all through, you read the prophets, my gosh, just zap, zap, zap all over the place with all kinds of acts of judgment. And Joel and the so on. You go down the line. And Ezekiel, which I won't spend a lot of time on, Ezekiel is just full of divine acts of wrath. One act of wrath, or wrath, how do you say it?
Wrath.
One act of wrath after another, right? Where some British say wrath, Australians say wrath, say wrath. Okay, get it right. These acts come from heaven. And mostly when we see this contrast, the focus is on God is in heaven, and on earth are humans, right? And what happens in these acts of revelation frequently is that humans are being punished, but who gets hurt?
Earth.
Yes. Think of the plagues. God is trying to wake up the Egyptians, but fills the Nile with blood. Now, it's not very healthy for the Nile. Is it? Or the boils on the cattle. Not boils on the people, boils on the cattle. What's another plague?
Locusts.
Locusts eat all the grass, doesn't it? Into the people. So almost throughout, when God says punishment on humans, who suffers? Earth. And so you have earth repeatedly suffering for human beings. Now, I want to come back to that a little bit later on. But you see, it's if you ask the question, when you read the text from the point of view of women, you're concerned about how women are simply oppressed in one way or another. If you ask the question, read the text from the point of view of Earth, you discover that Earth suffers unjustly. Why should Earth suffer? Because of what humans do. Why?
Humans are part of the Earth. We often, too often tend to separate humans from Earth or the ecological systems or processes.
That's true. Where humans are the ones who cause the evil, that's understandable. But my point is that God is portrayed as cursing the earth or punishing the earth, and the earth suffers because of what humans have done. And it's that concern that I have as background. I want to come back to that, but my main point initially is to say, when we think about Revelation, we think in a special way about God intervening from heaven onto earth in some way or another. And most of our portraits of Revelation are portraits of God's self-revelation or God in action in some way. This is background to the understanding of Revelation before we go into the text itself. I want to repeat what I said yesterday. The whole concept of heavenism, where we say that ultimately the important, eternal, spiritual, powerful, beautiful place is heaven, and that's really where we should be. So it doesn't matter what God does to earth, because we ultimately belong in heaven. That whole concept of the evaluation of earth and the devaluation of it, evaluation of heaven and the devaluation of earth, that process which has been part and parcel of my growing up and possibly of yours as well. So I want to keep in mind, and one of the ways of devaluing earth is to be able is to send these kind of plagues where the earth can be seen to be punishable, hit, hurt, because of what humans do. And that's part of the whole model of heavenism that I've been trying to identify. Now I want to ask one more question, and those of you who are scientists in my midst can give me the answers to this. If I ask the question of origins now, what are some of the major theories, ideas, beliefs, assertions about the origin of Earth? Earth is?
Big Bang.
Right, so you've got Big Bang theory. Everything explodes in all directions. Now they're trying to say negative. There's all kinds of stuff which I don't really understand. But in that Big Bang, one bit of stardust is called Earth.
Well, before that, Earth is formed out of a previous supernova star. Okay.
We have a supernova
which produced all the elements.
And all the elements that created are evolved out of that supernova.
Yeah.
And from that, you get one speck of stardust, which is Earth. Right? Anything else from the scientists? I'm not a scientist. I simply accept. Anyone else who is a scientist? You a scientist? Okay. Quite clearly, there is, and the period of time here is billions of years, isn't it? According to them. And there's a piece of stardust, and initially it's what? Molten hot. And then gradually it slows down, or gradually cools down. And somehow, out of that cooling down, there's the first bit of moisture, and eventually the processes of life. So the portrait of the origins of Earth are quite fascinating and interesting. And I'm not here to try and prove or disprove that. I simply want to say that in the background, we've got this as part and parcel of our world and our culture. What I want to do now is to take you to the story of the origins of Earth, or the story about Earth in Genesis 1. I want to read it with you from the point of view of Earth. And this is what the series that we've been doing is, I've mentioned before, readings from the perspective of Earth. And the story about Genesis 1 is one of those. Now, you're all free to get a Bible at this point if you want. So we can go into the text. Got one, Lauren? Yeah. Now, you've read this 1,000 times or 100 times or many times, and I did too until a few years ago when I started asking a new set of questions. And discovered all sorts of things that I didn't even dream were there. Now, the first verse, Genesis 1 verse 1, which is very well known to you, is usually considered to be the title, the heading, the superscription for the whole story, right? And how does it read?
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Okay. Now, the first problem we face is that that superscription says God creates heavens and earth. Now, from all that we've done this week, when you hear the word heaven, you think about what? When you think about heaven, you think about. If I say heaven, the world above us, the world of God, God, angels, right.
Stars.
If I, on the other hand, say, in the beginning God created the skies and earth, what's the difference? What's the difference if I say skies?
Atmosphere.
I'm talking about the physical universe. If I say heaven, I've got the potential of the spiritual world of God and all those other things.
That's the trouble with the word heavens. It has two different...
That's right. And so easily, we've said this refers to both domains. Heaven, the domain of God, and the domain of earth. Mm-hmm. But the word in Hebrew, so that you might know, is shamayim. And it's been translated both ways. Skies and earth. Now, my contention is that it's unequivocally the physical universe. It has nothing to do with the realm of God at all. Why do I say that? What happens on day two? God says, I need some. What happens on day two?
Water.
There's water there. There's water all over the shop. I need to separate the waters. And what does he use to separate the waters? You want to read it? Day two.
Wind. The earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face...
On day two, which is about... I'm sorry, the right verse.
Day two, okay.
Day two, not verse two.
Verse six.
Yes, verse six.
Six. Let's see. That's... Yeah. And God said, let there be a dome in the midst of the waters and let it separate the waters from the waters.
Okay. God said, let there be a dome. So make a dome... and have waters on top and waters below, and that's the dome that separates waters from waters. And what did he call the dome?
Sky.
It's the same word. It's the same word. It's the same word, you see. So it's clear that that word in this context means this thing here. The atmosphere, the sky, and all the rest of it. So it's from where I sit, this is nothing to do with creating the domain of God or some spiritual world at all. It's about the physical world. Clear? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's quite explicit then if you go to day two. Now, Now we need to look at what is the portrayal. Is this a story about the origin of Earth or something else? Read verse 2. How does verse 2 start?
The earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep.
All right. Who is the title? Who is the character, the key character in verse 2?
The earth.
The story is about the earth. The story is about earth. That's the character. You say this is a superscription, and then you go on. This is a story about earth. Right? Earth was. So it describes earth. It not describes what's not there. It describes what is there. This is not a story about the non-existence of Earth coming into existence. It's a story about Earth and what Earth was like and what God did about it. Right?
Are you saying the Earth was there before God created anything?
In this chapter, Earth was there. Earth was what? Let's read it. Earth was, basically it says, empty and had no life on it. Okay, but it's there. It may have no life on it yet, and it may be empty, but it's there. Right? Mm-hmm. Okay, it was empty and light, and then it says, what about it? Let's say this is Earth for the time being, something like that. And what else is there? Earth was empty and?
Darkness was covered with anything deep.
And then keep going?
Wind swept over the face of the water.
All right, so you've got, what have you got? You've got earth and waters and wind. And everything is in darkness, so you can't see. Right? Let's be clear about this. This is a picture of the way it was before God started creating. Because God doesn't start creating till day one. This is not day one yet. This is pre-day one. Be clear, this is pre-day one, right?
But sometime after the Big Bang.
Quite a while after the Big Bang. Yes, I'm not trying to harmonize the two, but it's a nice line. Thank you. The point is that this is a story from their world, and they're trying to understand the mystery of Earth. And so they're telling a story about how Earth came to be the way it is, but it doesn't start with Earth not being there. It starts with verse 2. Earth is, and there are four things to know. There's Earth, which has got no life in it yet, it's empty. It's inside the waters, right? There's a wind or a breath of God blowing through the waters, and it's all in darkness, right? The whole thing is in darkness. We can't switch those off. But now, where's the light that goes for that one? Do you know?
Which one?
The light that puts see there?
You want them out or on?
I want it out just for the fun of it. I don't think that works, does it? Oh, yeah, sorry. All right. This is in darkness. You have to understand we're all in darkness. You can't see what I just put on the board. But what's there is darkness and water and earth, and the wind. That's what's in the text. I'm not making it up. Is that clear?
Clear.
Thank you. Now, if I've got darkness and earth in the water, and the wind blowing through the water, what do I need for earth to be unveiled?
Light.
So you start, you need light to start with, don't you? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you need light. And that's nothing to do with sun or moon. Absolutely nothing. What you've got is a scenario, and God says, lights, camera, action, as it were. Right? You've got to have light. Now, the Aboriginal friends of mine who were doing this portrayal said, well, you know, where does the light come from? How do you portray it? And so they had lightning coming out. So lightning appears, doesn't it, when there's no sun? Nothing to do with sun, is it? But what you've got is this portrait. Now for those strangers who just moved in, I'll just repeat that one line. Verse 2 is a portrayal of earth that is empty, inside the water, inside the darkness, with a wind blowing through. That's what you got. And this lady has agreed with me, that's what's there. We haven't got to day one. We haven't got to day one, which is the first day of creation. We haven't got there. You're able to smile still. That's good. All right. Day one is yet to come. And day one, since all this is in darkness and you can't see it, right? God says light. And what do you see? A heck of a lot of water. So all you see is water, because the whole thing, windy water, blowing up and down, making not with wind blowing through it and saying, purple.
Wrong session.
And that's where I got the chirple from, is the water, the wind blowing through the water. I'm being biblical when I do my children's things. Sort of. Anyway, this is what we've got then. Pre-day one, a scene which is most simple. A lot of water. Now, lots of parts of the world, you have a similar story, where the beginning of the world is water. In a certain strange sense, water is primary to the whole origins of life. Now, the second day, God's got to sort out this problem. We need a little bit more room here. Okay? Day one, we've got some light. And when you put light on the scene, all you get is water, right? Now you see the water, but you don't see the earth yet, because it's in the water. Waiting, latent, potential, all sorts of things. So day two, it says what? And God said, let there be
a dome.
In
the midst of the waters.
So we now have a dome here, and the function of this dome in this story is so that the waters above are separated from the waters below. So what you've got now is a big ceiling with waters on top of it and waters on below. You still with me? Mm-hmm. That's good. Right. Now, that ceiling, as I said before, God calls sky. And that's exactly the same word that's at the beginning. In the beginning, God created the sky and the earth. Nothing to do with the domain of God whatsoever. This is the physical universe we're talking about. Okay? Now, all the waters, better to have a blue, isn't it? The waters are here and the waters are there. I'm not an artist, but I can read the text. Now, what do I need to do? One more thing. By having this dome here, you not only separate the waters, but you provide a space for something to happen. Like a stage. Right? Mm-hmm. A stage is set for something to happen. Now we've got waters on top, we've got waters below, and we've got earth hidden in the waters. What has to happen? What has to happen given this scene? Cool.
Day
three has to happen. Absolutely. That's absolutely brilliant. Day three has to happen. Yes. What has to happen on day three?
Dry land appear.
We've got to somehow get this here out of here, haven't we? Mm-hmm. We've got to get earth, which is under the waters, out of the water. Thank you. Now, so on the third day, God says, let what? Let the land, the earth, appear. Now, I want to spend a moment or two on that. This is not a creation of earth out of nothing. It is the emergence of earth from the waters. Now, there's a series of images that are here that are important. When you have something emerging out of the waters, it's much like a birth. Good. But more than a birth, it's a birth imagery is there. But what I want to specially say, and hope you will if you remember nothing else than that, than this, when it says let the dry land appear, that word that's used there, appear, is very special. That word, let the dry land appear, that word appear is the same word that is used when God appears. When God is revealed, when there's a revelation of God, what we call a theophany. When we have a theophany, when God is manifest, is a certain Hebrew word, which is a version, a niphal of Ra'ah, for those who are interested, but for the rest of you, take my word for it, it's the same word that's used when God appears. And it's rare, you see, to have it anywhere else but God. Huh. It's not a common everyday word for anybody doing it. God does it, and here, who does it? Earth. Earth is revealed. By using that word with earth, you have upped the status, you have valued it, you have made it recognized to be something special, something remarkable, something like God. And in order to capture that, I, in my more technical articles, use the expression geophony. Not theophony, geophony. The appearance or manifestation of earth from the deep, from the waters. That special, remarkable birth. So what this story does, it doesn't try to do what the scientists do. It tries to say in the language, in the culture of the ancient world, that the earth is that remarkable creature that is born of the waters from the very beginning and appears with the same kind of brilliance and beauty that God does. Questions? Thoughts?
Is geophony a new word?
It is. It's a horrible word. I could not find another word to capture. But scholars like words like this. In a sense, if you like, when you've got the Big Bang and the star flying out, it's a geophony. It's the first appearance of that planet. That's a form of geophony. This is the biblical version of geophony, of how Earth first appears. And so in a sense, it's another portrait. I'm not trying to harmonize the two. I'm simply saying they're different portraits from different cultures and different times. But it does say something about the Earth as not simply a disposable piece of rubbish that comes at the end of time. It's something that God has chosen to specially reveal as that which is our life source. And a wonderful thing. Now, this word now is flying around in a few places. It's like, what Harville calls geophony, they say. But I still think it's a valuable word because it helps to capture the parallel with theophony, the connection. So God reveals or calls on, summons earth. It's God actually speaks to earth and says, earth, let earth come out. It doesn't say, let there be earth, that is. It's quite different, isn't it? Let earth exist. No, it says, let earth be seen, revealed, uncovered, unveiled. Okay? Now, that might be enough, excepting that after earth is uncovered, God doesn't say, let there be anything. Then God goes on and says, speaks to earth and says, let earth, I want you to bring forth what? Let the earth,
vegetation.
Let the earth bring forth plants and trees and vegetation and things with nuts and so on. So you don't have a creation of plants. You have, again, a revelation, an emergence, an appearance of plants from earth. Inside of earth is all that potential. Life is within earth from the beginning, and God summons it forth. Earth is not called Mother Earth, but it's equivalent to the parent from whom all life comes. And so out of earth come all the plants, God doesn't say, let there be plants. He says, earth, you bring forth the plants. So earth is not only a theophany, but is a source, the parent of all the life, of all those plants and those. Questions? Okay. Now, that's day three. And day three now has two parts of it. First, the appearance of earth, and then the appearance of the plants and so forth from the earth. Day four, God says, I now need to put some stars and lights in the sky, because just ordinary light without that's not adequate. So God puts the sun and the moon and the stars in the sky, and therefore times and seasons, and to do what? To put light on the earth. Earth is still the central character of the story. This is a story about earth, not really a story about creation. So God, the story tells you what earth was like, then how earth appears, then what earth does, and what was needed to give earth light and signs and seasons. Okay? Yep.
Are you sure that maybe the author didn't get the third and fourth days turnaround? Because the plants suggest, for the most part, photosynthesis.
Yeah.
They didn't know that anymore.
My hunch is that, my hunch is that their culture didn't quite appreciate that subtlety about the relationship. But normally, if one were doing it, one would want to. But on the other hand, there is light was created, whatever form that light was, on the first day. So there's a sense in which light as a source of life. And if you read John 1, it's made clear that the light was the life of everything. So life as a source is created in some sense first, according to John. But John 1 is a very different text, and you shouldn't try and harmonize the two. They're two very different portraits. Often people want to say, make a harmony so that you have them all the same. John 1, which says in the beginning was the Word, and it's a very different portrait, a very different story. And it's not a story about earth, it's a story about the Word of God. So don't try and make the two the same. Genesis 1's about earth. John 1's about the Word becoming flesh. Two different stories. Now, then we move on to day 5 and 6, and God starts to talk. On day 5, God talks to the water. He says, I want the water to bring forth what? Fish and all the things in the water. And in addition, I want a few sea monsters. For fun, he adds the sea monsters. I never quite know why. There's all sorts of arguments about what happened. So that day, the waters bring forth fish, and the sky brings forth birds, and so on. But they're all out of the elements that exist. It doesn't say let there be, but may the waters bring forth. And then what I had not noticed for many years, on the sixth day, God says, all right, earth, I now want you to bring forth what? Animals. All kinds of animals. Let the earth bring forth animals. God doesn't say let there be animals. God says let the earth bring forth the animals. So once again, earth is the parent of all life. You follow me? So my goal in trying to study this is to say that this is a story about earth, not primarily a story about creation. The key, or at least if you call it a story about creation, the key character in the story is earth. What it was, what it was like before day one, and how each day something is done so that earth is revealed and is made the source of life and functions as the source of life for everything. Question? You happy with that, Dan? What do you think?
Oh, man.
It's a good line, yeah, good line. And it's, what we've done is to affirm Earth and value Earth in a way that often has not been done. And that story does it. Right? And when later on you go to Genesis 2, you find that human beings also come out of Earth, although it's not clear in Genesis 1.
So the whole... In verse 26, that the one... Yeah, I guess you were just... I don't know if you were going there, but it's... Human beings don't come out of here.
No.
This is story.
Now, I now have to face what is the problem of the text. Thank you very much for that. Everything comes out of the earth, and in Genesis 2, human beings come out of the earth. But there's something that happens in all of this which is completely and totally, I would call, different from the rest of the story. Those three verses, 1:26 to 28, which we talked about the other day, those three verses are quite different in tone and focus and emphasis than the rest of the chapter. Now, what do you do with that? There are several ways to go. It says that God says, let us make humans in our image. And we've talked about that one before. I'll talk about it again now. Let us make humans in our image. In other words, make human beings differently than we made the rest. Everything else emerges from the earth, but humans don't in the story. In chapter 2, they do come from the earth. So you have two very diametrically opposed stories. Chapter 2 and chapter 1.
Who is us?
Ah.
God and...
Us.
The Trinity.
Us, not the Trinity. That came at Nicaea, as it was pretty clear today.
Isn't that God and earth?
The question is, who is us?
Could be the royal we, you know.
There's three explanations possible. The royal we, because in Egypt very often the king would speak about us when he meant himself. That's why it's called royal. So one option is the royal we from ancient literature. The second option is that's God and earth, but nobody's said that until you and me. And the sense in which that might very well be right. The third is that the us is the council of heaven. The way you have a council in a lot of ancient Near Eastern texts in Babylon, the council meets and decides that because the gods have got too much hard work looking after earth, we'll create some humans. And so the us refers to the council, heavenly council. You remember in Job, the heavenly... And they have a discussion, a debate about this character Job down on earth. So you've got some places, a few places, which have the heavenly council. Whichever one you take, usually the most common one understanding is that it's the council of heaven. In other words, we want to make human beings like us, the gods. Right? Now, if that's the case, then you've got a text here where humans are made differently than the rest of creation. And if that's the case, then this text is in sharp conflict with the rest of the story. In tension with the rest of the story. And you have several ways to go. As I've said the other day, since you've raised it, clearly it has to be discussed. Now, I'll give you the ways to go with this. You have one option, is to say, this is designed, by the way, I need to follow a bit further. Not only are humans in the image of God, they've got two functions to do because they're in the image of God. Read verses 1:26 to 28. The first function is that they're supposed to rule all the creatures. That's one function. And the second one is they're supposed to subdue earth. Now, why I say that's in tension with the rest is that here you have this wonderful portrait of the revelation of earth, the beauty of earth, and suddenly you come along and saying somebody's going to have to rule them. And the second is somebody has to subdue the earth. Earth is this beautiful revelation, and suddenly you've got to subdue it. Why? It seems to be in complete tension. Now, you've got two options. You can say, all right, it was intended to be a conflict that's there from the beginning. Or you can say, there were two different people who were writing. This group, this person who was writing with a great sympathy for the earth. This person, who was a priest, decided we've got to have control. Now, not many people like the idea of two writers, two files, as it were, one file stuck in with the other one. The story was beautifully complete without verses 21 to 26, 26 to 28. And I'd like them not to be there. I have a problem because they are there, right? Now, you can do two things. You can say rule and subdue are really nice words. And that they aren't nasty at all. But I have studied those two words in great detail. And they mean, rule means to dominate, like the king will dominate a foreign nation and control it. Subdue means to crush, like you crush grapes. They are not nice words, and people who try to make them nice, I have to be honest with the text. So what you've got is a text which is intrusive in this text and reflects an orientation of control and domination. What changes the picture is that if you read Genesis 2, verse 15, what happens in Genesis 2, verse 15? God creates this wonderful garden for Adam and Eve to live in, and after he's created it, God says, this is what I want you to do in this garden with all the animals and all the creatures. This is what I want you to do. You have to do two things. You have to till and protect. Now, those of you who have heard this once before will know what I'm saying, but the word till also means serve. You are to serve the earth like you would serve a parent or a king or somebody else. So Genesis 2 has a totally different orientation. And in fact, if you look at the Hebrew, this word rule and this word serve are what we call antonyms, diametric opposites. This word crush and this word protect are opposites. It's almost like somebody wrote chapter 2 to say, don't listen to chapter 1.
Which was written earlier?
This one. Most scholars would say Genesis 2 was written much, much earlier. Mm. And later you have Genesis 1 written after kings had come into power and all this royal language of control and power. Mm. And so you've transferred the imagery. This is the imagery of people serving in the temple, serving one another, serving and helping. That's what's in the text. You've got Genesis 1 text with attention, you've got Genesis 2, 15, which is totally consistent with the rest of Genesis 1. What I do as a Lutheran, maybe not what you do, I then ask the question, ultimately, which of these two texts should I be supporting and why? Should I automatically say, I will believe and follow everything? I can't do that. If that was true, I couldn't have any cream with my meal. Because in the Old Testament it says you're not allowed to have that. All sorts of fascinating things that you don't do. I couldn't eat lobster or crab, which I love. What I do is to say, what does the gospel say? How should I live if I live according to the gospel? The way of the wilderness that Dan's been talking about. What's that way? Is that way a way of domination or a way of serving? And if I go to this very well-known text in Mark 10:45, Jesus says, look, I don't want you to be like the Gentile rulers who control and dominate. I want you to learn to serve. To serve, just as the Son of Man came to serve and give his life for me as a ransom. Now, you can do what some people want to do and say every text is equally important and powerful and so on. I believe you can't do that. You must do what Dan has been saying. The gospel, the message of God, is in a box called a manger. That was Luther's language. And you need to look at the rest of it in the light of the gospel. And I would argue that the first part of Genesis is beautifully consistent with the message. And the Genesis 2 text is consistent with the message of the gospel. Genesis 1, 26 to 28 has been overturned. reversed. It's no longer what I want as a gospel Christian. I don't want a world where we dominate earth and crush it. It's not where we're at. The gospel has changed our relationship not only to each other, but to earth. That would be my argument. Comments? You see what I've done? I've moved from being a biblical scholar to being a Lutheran theologian. And in a sense, I can just say and tell you all about the text, but if I want to live with it, I need to say that there is a gospel message which is now what determines which of these texts becomes ones that I'm going to really listen to and work with. And the Genesis 2 text is full of life and meaning, and the other one is a problem, and has been used in the history of Christianity and Western thought as a justification for doing all sorts of things to build, as you all know. Questions? Any questions? Comments? Thoughts? Revelations? Yes?
Well, you shared Genesis. I'm just curious, what are the other passages in your collection there? Where does this go from here? So you got my curiosity.
It goes, well, I'll take one. I mean, it goes on and on and on. There are lots of other earth, what I call earth files.
Mm-hmm.
The flood story is one. Job 38, 39 is another one. Mm-hmm. Psalm 104 is another one. Proverbs 8 is an absolutely fantastic one. And we'll deal with that tomorrow. But for now, let me just give you what happens in the flood story. And why is the flood story helpful to follow this? I'll give you one more. What time is it?
Yeah.
I'm going to go and make an announcement for a couple of minutes. All right. The flood story in 5 minutes. It took how long? How long did the flood last?
40 days.
One whole year. It only rained for 40 days. A whole year the flood lasted. Right. God says, the earth is a mess. Human beings are evil. So I am going to send a flood. So you've got this dome here, you remember? And you've got earth here. And the water under it. So God says, let the waters come. So he opens the heavens. And those waters that were up here, you remember? They come down. And the waters that are under here come up. So you get the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven opening, and the whole earth is returned to what? What? The way it was before creation. The only difference is that instead of a wind blowing across, there's a boat floating across with Noah on it. Now, if that's the case, we've returned to essentially back, and God's starting all over again. Then God says, all right, we've got to finally get rid of this water, and finally on a certain day, the peak appears, and the boat's sitting on top of this mountain, and you're back to day one of creation, or day three of creation. First mountain peak is there, the boat sits on it, and what day is it? It's New Year's Day. The first day, the beginning of a new year. Fascinating. All the symbolism of the flood story is full. And when God sees this, God says, two different times, at the end of chapter 8, God says, I will never curse earth because of what?
Humans.
Now that promise, it's an extraordinary one. I will not curse earth. You remember when Adam and Eve came out of the garden, God did what? God cursed the earth because of what Adam did. I'm not going to do that anymore. Well, it's not sure that was carried through as a promise, but it's an important promise. That's chapter 8. In chapter 9, God says, now I'm not only going to make that promise that I won't curse again, I am now going to promise that I will never destroy earth again with water. And who did he promise that to? Humans, animals, and earth. promise is made to Earth, not just to humans, that that destruction of Earth would never happen again. So you have the story of Earth continues, but we tend to only think of it in story of, in terms of the story of humans. This is a story of God's relationship to Earth as much as it is God's relationship to humans. Now, if some of you want to, I have to go and make announcements. Some of you want to write a letter to Earth which reflects some of your thoughts and feelings, please do so. Tomorrow we will start, we'll do at 9 o'clock. I'm doing the Bible study tomorrow morning, so it's the guru of Bible studies is not here tomorrow, so I have been asked to do it. But you're still here, though. What the blazes? Why can't you do it?
I'm retired.
Angels never retire. Well, whatever. We will continue. Neither Dan or I will do the Bible study at 9 o'clock tomorrow. And I will move into some of the other... But we might need to... if we have a quite a number of people, we might just need to quickly review what we've just done and then move on into the next parts. Some of the other texts, some of the other files. Okay, so, but write something if you want to and give it to me or tell me tomorrow morning. Thanks very much.
Norm, is your email address in that flyer?